been pulled back home. On the U.S. side, however, it was business almost as usual. Spy subs had gotten more cautious. Improvements in sonar and the electronics intercept gear meant they no longer had to go quite as close to Soviet subs or shore to capture intelligence. Los Angeles subs weren't as maneuverable in tight spots anyway. The pace of operations had not let up. For instance, Submarine Squadron 11 in San Diego alone sent 8 of its 10 nuclear attack submarines out on surveillance operations in 1988, keeping up with the rate set during the height of the Cold War. The USS Salt Lake City, SSN 716, operated for nearly 7 months in the Northern Pacific, followed by the USS Portsmouth, SSN 707, the USS Pintado, SSN 672, the USS La Jolla, SSN 701, and others. The pace of operations was fueled by signs that the Soviets had finally learned to build subs as powerful and more important, nearly as silent as American subs. There was a colossal irony to all of this. Just as the Soviets had finally learned to construct first-class submarines, they were running out of money to build and operate them. But that realization had yet to filter down through the ranks on either side. And so, out on Mare Island, the pace of special projects operations didn't let up much. Seawolf had been retired in 1987, and Parchee had gone into overhaul so that she could be modified to handle a wider array of potential projects. She was cut in half to fit in a 100-foot section that would hold new sophisticated equipment for cable tapping and gear to allow her to retrieve objects from the ocean floor, as Seawolf had. The overhaul was scheduled to take several years, but even so, the United States continued cable tapping without pause, having readied Parchee's replacement, the Richard B. Russell, named after the senator whose name had once been synonymous with a wink and a nod, and nearly blank-check acceptance of all intelligence operations. From 1987 through 1990, the Russell collected one award for each trip to the Barents, one presidential unit citation, and 3 Navy unit commendations. Her missions went on as Reagan left office in early 1989, and Bush came in, as Bush and Gorbachev picked up where Reagan and Gorbachev had left off, and even after Bush wrote privately to Gorbachev, offering to help the Soviets retrieve one of their submarines that had been lost in the Norwegian Sea. The lost boat, the Komsomolets, was a 6,400-ton prototype of a new class of Soviet nuclear sub known as the Mike, designed to dive much deeper than other full-size attack subs. It was the 4th Soviet nuclear submarine to sink during the Cold War. While even more Soviet nuclear and diesel subs were crippled by reactor accidents, fires, or other mishaps, at least 7 or 8 sank outright. Later that year, Trost was invited to Leningrad, the honored guest of the Soviet Navy. On this trip, a month before the Berlin Wall crumbled, he was given a first-hand look at how rapidly Soviet submarine capabilities were dwindling. The Soviets were having trouble keeping their subs at sea, paying for maintenance and running enough operations to train their crews. Trost was stunned by the changes that had taken place since he last visited the Soviet Union in 1971, a time when he knew his room had been bugged, and he and his cohorts followed, so overtly, in fact, that the Navy men had stopped in their tracks to offer to tell their Soviet shadow where they were headed. Now there seemed to be no spies. Instead, there were frank discussions, admiral to admiral, about the difficulties of keeping a Navy running, about the futility of nuclear warfare. Indeed, Trost got his first look at Soviet submarine construction and the problems facing Soviet commanders. They saw subs on which sometimes only the officers spoke Russian, and conscripts from the republics were so ill-trained that only the officers could manage much of the critical maintenance necessary to keep the boats at sea. But perhaps the most telling moment occurred when Trost and the top Soviet admiral, Vladimir N. Chernavin, began joking, or half-joking, that their fates were linked. If either side failed to maintain an adequate-sized navy, the other would have a terrible time justifying his defense expenditures. The world was changing from beneath them almost as fast as East and West Berliners had torn down the wall with hammers, rocks, and their bare hands. By now, top State Department officials had begun to worry about anything that could undermine Gorbachev as he continued to move toward closer relations with the United States. Their concern fell on the Russell cable-tapping mission that was scheduled for when Gorbachev and Bush were to meet again. In the end, the timing of Russell's trip was changed. But one changed mission was not necessarily enough. Some diplomatic officials worried that the intelligence community was adapting too slowly from its long-held views of the Soviet Union. There was no doubt that after 40 years, the nation's spies were reluctant to be deprived of their enemy. What would happen to the intelligence agencies when nobody cared about the measurements of weaponry, of force? What would happen in a world when the most crucial information came not from covert efforts, but from the cable news network and its 24-hour reports about the sweeping social changes? That the submarine force faced these questions with concern and some resentment was evident when retired and current officers met at the annual convention of the Naval Submarine League in June 1990. Around the world, shards of the Berlin Wall were being sold as souvenirs, but within the convention halls at a Radisson Hotel outside Washington, D.C., it was certain that nobody would be crying out for a peace dividend. Not a single man would eye the submarine fleet with a scowl on his face, a calculator in hand, figuring the myriad social programs that could be funded, even in one boat's stead. The specter of the bean counters, however, loomed large, even in their absence. The man who was now Secretary of the Navy, H. Lawrence Garrett III, stood before the assemblage and warned that budget cutters are sharpening their knives even as we speak. He failed to mention that the sharpest knife was coming from General Colin Powell, who had succeeded Crow as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and had just announced that the military budget would probably have to be cut by 25% over the next several years. Garrett, taking a far harder line, went on to dismiss any effect that perestroika and glasnost might have on the game of submarine spying. The logic of nuclear deterrence has not changed just because the Soviet leader routinely presses the flesh on Pennsylvania Avenue, he thundered. Other speakers were more moderate, but still called for prudence and skepticism when it came to the Soviet Union. William H.J. Manthorpe, Jr., then Deputy Director of Naval Intelligence, posed the question that was quickly becoming the rallying cry of the submarine force. What will be the intentions of the Soviet leadership of the future? Can we depend on those intentions being benign? The answer, of course, is no. I would not bet my country's security on it. Before long, though, something happened that convinced even the most hard-line skeptics that the Soviet Union was no longer the most likely candidate to drag the United States into a war. Almost as if he realized that there was room on center stage for a new villain, Saddam Hussein stepped forward from Iraq and, overnight, annexed Kuwait. The United States had a new reason to fight, and this time it stood shoulder to shoulder with the Soviet Union, issuing an unprecedented joint statement denouncing the blatant transgression of basic norms of civilized conduct and calling for an arms embargo against Iraq. Secretary of State James A. Baker III would later proclaim that this was the day the Cold War ended. When war finally broke out in the Persian Gulf in January 1991, submarines played only a bit part. Still, the conflict dramatized the need to refocus defense efforts on regional conflicts, and with an eye to ensuring its place in future conflicts, the submarine force highlighted the role that it played against Iraq for all it was worth. The USS Louisville, SSN 724, and the USS Pittsburgh, SSN 720, together had fired a dozen Tomahawk cruise missiles against inland targets in Iraq. Other attack submarines stood guard for cargo ships in the Mediterranean, protecting vast quantities of war supplies. A string of subs from the United States and its allies, Turkey, Greece, Spain, Britain, France, and Italy, were positioned from the Strait of Gibraltar to the Suez Canal. The war gave the sub force a chance to show its versatility, to show that it could do more than just chase Soviet subs and shadow Soviet ports. It also gave submariners themselves a sense that they could create a new mission, a comforting realization given the fact that any lingering doubts about Soviet intentions were soon to be wiped out by one dramatic event after another. Bush and Gorbachev announced a new deal to cut strategic stockpiles by one-third. Boris Yeltsin rescued Gorbachev from a reactionary coup, signaling the last failed gasp of the communist hardliners. And in a richly symbolic move, Bush also grounded the Strategic Air Command bombers that had been on near-constant alert for 32 years. The Pentagon began rethinking the nation's military strategy. The sub-force knew it was going to have to recreate itself, just as it had been forced to do after World War II. It needed to find a new job and new enemies. There was no question that for much of the Cold War, submarines, missile, and attack boats taken together could stake claim to being the nation's most critical naval weapons. That made sense when the chief enemy had a fleet that was nearly as formidable. But the 1990s were bringing fundamental change, and it was already clear that the submarine was bound to fall from the Pantheon. Like the clipper ships in their day, subs had been perfectly suited to their time, and they had so dominated that they defined an epoch. For its part, the Navy started simply at first, writing new rules in mid-1991 legislating greater distances and caution for U.S. subs trailing Soviet subs. Then the Office of Naval Intelligence recommended that the number of missions off the Soviet coast be cut dramatically. No longer would the U.S. Navy try to maintain cast-iron coverage of the largest Soviet naval bases. No longer would one surveillance sub follow in the wake of another to Soviet waters. No longer would they keep constant watch, waiting for something, anything, interesting to happen. Not even the vaunted special project subs were sacred any longer. Desperate to update their fleet of spy satellites, the CIA and the Air Force began to eye the hundreds of millions of dollars still being invested in those subs. Because both Russell and Parchee were in the shipyard throughout 1991, neither doing any missions, the rival agencies were able to suggest that two special projects boats might be too much of a luxury. The process of attrition was stopped short by the surprising dissolution of the Soviet Union. On Christmas Day, 1991, the Commonwealth of Independent States, a loose federation of republics, formally replaced the Soviet Union. Soon after, reports began coming out of a meeting of 5,000 Russian military officers that painted a portrait of confusion, anger, and abject frustration. Members of the now shattered Soviet Navy yanked the old hammer and sickle standards from their ships and began flying the flag of St. Andrew, which had marked Russian ships since the days of Peter the Great. Now U.S. naval intelligence desperately wanted to know who would get control of the Soviet missile subs, and how they would be deployed under the new regimes. Renewed surveillance had its price. On February 11, 1992, the USS Baton Rouge, SSN 689, collided with a Russian Sierra-class boat, among the newest and quietest to come out of the Soviet shipyards. Baton Rouge was tracking the Sierra near the 12-mile limit off Murmansk when the American commander lost his contact, which then struck Baton Rouge from below. Neither sub was damaged much, and nobody was hurt, but the incident was embarrassing. Yeltsin quickly complained, and Baker met with him in Moscow to keep things calm. The next day, in an unprecedented move, the Pentagon publicly announced that the collision had occurred, and the Russian Navy began to complain publicly that the United States was still operating too close to its waters. In the end, this embarrassment was what accelerated the shift in submarine surveillance away from Russia. The President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, chaired by retired Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, examined the Special Projects Program. Shortly thereafter, Naval Intelligence was told that the Board had decided that there was no longer any need for more than one Special Project sub, and that if the Navy was going to keep tapping underwater cables, then maybe it was time to find some cables in other parts of the world. U.S. attack subs had already handled reconnaissance off countries like Lebanon and Libya, and in the mid-1980s, two old missile subs had been converted to carry SEALs. The USS John Marshall, SSN 611, had bobbed around in the Mediterranean for 2 months with 50 SEALs aboard during one crisis in Lebanon in 1989, waiting, if needed, to rescue hostages or mount a retaliatory strike. Now, as part of the Navy's new from-the-sea military strategy, subs would ride shotgun for aircraft carriers and cruisers and take orders from task force commanders riding on those vessels. But the submarine force would also continue to lurk, unseen, near potential arenas of conflict and come up with the intelligence to prepare the battlefield before the task forces were ever called in. The term had been borrowed from the Army, but in this case it meant sending subs out 2, 3, 4, or more years before any anticipated conflicts to learn more about nations that loomed as potential foes, to determine their weaknesses, and to pave the way for U.S. victories in conflicts that would have fewer casualties because of these undersea efforts. Iran, for instance, had already taken delivery of the first of 3 Kilo diesel submarines, silent and highly advanced boats built in Russia. A top Iranian admiral had boasted that he intended to use these subs to gain control of the Strait of Hormuz, the entrance to Persian Gulf ports, and the starting point for about 1/6 of the world's oil. That was enough to send the USS Topeka, SSN 754, to the Persian Gulf to observe the Kilo's arrival in November 1992. It was typical of the new era of reconnaissance missions. The new spy missions raised no agonizing debates at the National Security Council or within the White House, which was still approving all sub-reconnaissance operations on a monthly basis. Still, there were accusations from Capitol Hill that the sub-force was merely inventing enemies to keep itself employed. The Navy's answer was simple. Some of the other targets had existed for years, and it was only the collapse of the Soviet Union that had offered the luxury of time and resources to allow subs to do a job they should have been doing all along. The enemies might be comparatively unsophisticated. An Iranian Kilo running on diesel power can't really be compared to the high-speed Akulas the Soviets sent out in the later years of the Cold War. But the U.S. Navy would still need to know how the Iranians would operate the Kilos, would still need to find their blind spots. Can you imagine the embarrassment to the U.S. Navy if the Kilos sank the USS America? Said one high-ranking Navy official. Pausing, he added, "Not on my watch." The shift to these new missions was well underway when President Bill Clinton took office in early 1993. But as he and his administration laid plans for his first summit with Yeltsin, scheduled for the first week of April, they got hit by what seemed to be an anachronistic and unwelcome blast from the past. On March 20th, the USS Grayling, SSN 646, collided with a Soviet missile sub in the Barents Sea. Grayling had been shadowing the Russian sub 105 miles north of Murmansk, smack in the middle of the Northern Fleet's training range. The Russians claimed that their sub had been moving for more than an hour at a steady speed, course, and depth when Grayling left a huge dent in their starboard bow. Nobody was hurt. The incident was everything the State Department had been worrying about since the final days of Reagan's tenure. Yeltsin was in the midst of a political crisis in Moscow. News that his friends within the United States were still sending submarines tooling about Russia's most sensitive ports and bases wasn't going to boost his popularity. At first, the Pentagon said Grayling had been trailing one of Russia's newest missile boats, a Delta IV, but the Russians insisted that Grayling had been hot on the trail of a Delta III, a class of subs that dated back to the late 1970s. This provoked more than a few stinging comments from other submariners, all along the lines that the Navy already had so much information on the Delta IIIs that we could build one from the hull up. Clinton was furious, and so were his aides. In exasperation, one senior administration official complained of the Navy's leaders. One wonders if they've read the newspapers. The Russian Defense Ministry issued an angry statement expressing great concern. It was one thing to take such risks during the Cold War, but now? As Rear Admiral Valery Alexeyin, the chief navigator, put it, "We walk on the razor edge. Once this hunt will end up in a disaster. I am sure today, too, that if such a practice doesn't stop, the disaster is inevitable." Clinton offered Yeltsin a formal apology and smoothed things over with him at the start of the summit in Vancouver, British Columbia, where he also pledged $1.6 billion in aid to support Yeltsin's reforms. Declaring the collision regrettable, Clinton said, "I don't want it to ever happen again." He ordered a review of both the incident and the policies, of which the incident happened to be an unintended part. That last part of Clinton's promise worried the Navy. There needed to be damage control, and fast. Rear Admiral Edward D. Schaefer, Jr., who was now the Director of Naval Intelligence, along with the captain who coordinated the submarine reconnaissance program, prepared a detailed briefing for top officials, including Clinton's new National Security Advisor, Anthony Lake, and his deputy, Samuel Berger. Strobe Talbot, the Deputy Secretary of State, and nearly everybody, it seemed, within the Office of Secretary of Defense, Les Aspin. The Navy team stressed that submarine spying had indeed changed with the times. Now, only 25% of the missions were directed toward Russian waters. The remaining 75% had turned to Middle Eastern waters to spy on Iran and enforce the economic embargo against Iraq, to the Adriatic to help seal off Bosnia from Western arms shipments, to the waters off Haiti to enforce an arms embargo there, and to monitor potential threats in the Far East. Finally, the submariners marched out their new rallying cry, the one about preparing the battlefields around the globe. It was a briefing as good as any offered up during the Cold War, one that showed how quickly the submarine force had reinvented itself. By the time Schaefer and his staff were done, even they were astonished. Here they had thought the Grayling collision might sink their program, and instead, the Naval Intelligence team ended up chortling that the collision saved our bacon. In their desperation, they did such an impressive job of touting the sub-force that several administration officials were practically cheering, saying things such as, "God damn, it's a free ocean," and "There's no prohibition against being outside another country's territorial waters." High administration officials who might never have focused on submarines and submarine spying were impressed that the Navy had changed so much without having to be dragged away from its old foe. The Navy even got the go-ahead to keep watching the Russians, albeit at this greatly reduced pace, as long as the reconnaissance was done more cautiously and judiciously. Since then, the submarine force has fared relatively well under Clinton. Perhaps his biggest favor has been keeping alive the Seawolf program. Clinton agreed to build three of the mammoth $2.5 billion attack subs rather than halt the program at one, as Bush had tried to do. Clinton said he was doing that to prevent the industrial base that builds submarines from shriveling and dying altogether. There was opposition from normally hawkish Republicans who described the Seawolf as a Cold War relic. Clinton also okayed a plan to build another new class of attack submarines, one smaller and cheaper than the Seawolf. Quieter and much more versatile than the Los Angeles subs, this new class, known first as the New Attack Submarine, or NSSN, and now the Virginia class, is designed for the array of new missions in shallow, regional waters. Clinton agrees that the Navy will need new subs after the turn of the century to replace some of the aging Los Angeles vessels. His support has taken some of the sting out of a dramatic downsizing of the force. From a high of 98 in the late 1980s, the number of attack subs has fallen to 65 by early 1999 and is now expected to dwindle to 50 early in the next century, and even further as the Los Angeles subs are retired. The fleet of nuclear missile subs, which are still circling quietly in the oceans, will dwindle to 10 to 14 boats, from a one-time high of 41. The Navy is asking Congress for the cash to build the new subs and is arguing that they will be capable of operating not only near third world countries, but also up against Russian shores. The Seawolf is said to be as much as 30 times quieter than the early Los Angeles-class subs that came out in the 1970s, and 10 times quieter than even the newest L.A.-class subs. Both Seawolf and the Virginia-class will be especially useful for the new missions closer in to shores and for assisting in conflicts on land. They will carry Tomahawk missiles, be equipped with sonar designed to be especially useful in the shallows, and they will be configured to carry detachments of Navy SEALs and other special forces. The Navy also has been pouring money into creating underwater drones and even small pilotless aircraft that could be controlled by these submarines and swim out ahead to look for mines or fly out to do surveillance. The subs in use now are also being upgraded with new microprocessing technologies to enable them to better communicate a variety of intelligence to commanders of task force battle groups, including email and photographs, even video taken through their periscopes. When the latest class of subs, the Virginia class, begin to set out to sea in 2004, they won't even have periscopes. Instead, they will have a fiber-optic mast with a digital video system with resolution clearer than the human eye. This same technology is also likely to help subs with some of the other new missions the Navy has taken on since the end of the Cold War. Subs have occasionally tipped the Coast Guard to suspicious trawlers in the Caribbean that have turned out to be carrying shipments of illegal drugs, and subs have been alerting surface ships to freighters suspected of trying to make illicit shipments of arms and other cargo in violation of U.S. embargoes. In the war over Kosovo in early 1999, when the NATO allies needed to make precision strikes against sensitive Serbian targets, U.S. attack subs and one British sub repeatedly fired Tomahawk cruise missiles from the Adriatic Sea. Subs also kept an eye out for Russian activity in the region. Still, the U.S. subforce remains most concerned with countering the threat from other submarines, including new models of both diesel and nuclear boats. Russia has been supplying advanced Kilo subs to Iran and China. Even some Western nations, such as Germany, have been exporting advanced diesel subs to third world countries. In addition, the Russians continue to view the submarine as the most important vessel in their navy, and they have kept improving the Akulas, their quietest and most sophisticated nuclear attack subs. There are still significant flaws in Russian technology. According to naval intelligence officials, the latest Akulas are very quiet below 10 knots, but they develop audible knocks at speeds above that and become easy to detect. The Russians also have started to build an even more advanced replacement, known as the Severodvinsk class, which some U.S. officials fear could be quieter than the improved Los Angeles subs. When and if a proposed START II treaty is finally ratified by the Russian Duma, the bulk of Russian nuclear might will shift to the sea. As long as Russia still has the world's second most powerful sub-force, as long as the bear still swims, as Navy briefers like to say, it needs to be watched, though now it has little money to send its subs to sea. Clinton has agreed to continue the limited surveillance operations off of Russia, and his approvals have resulted in a few lonely sentinels lurking off Vladivostok and Murmansk, at least at times when the Navy has reason to believe the Russians might be engaging in an exercise or testing new equipment. It also is with Clinton's nod that the Special Project Spy program has continued, although its focus has shifted away from Russia. Government officials say that one of the Special Project subs, probably Russell, in 1992, went back to the Barents to retrieve the tap pods after the Soviet Union collapsed. Russell went cable tapping in other parts of the world before she was retired in mid-1993. That's when Parche came back from her long overhaul, earning two more presidential unit citations in 1993 and 1994. After a string of Navy unit commendations in 1995, 1996, and 1997, Parche won another PUC in 1998. All told, Parche has now won at least 8 PUCs, by far the most of any ship in Navy history. Details of exactly where Parche is going now have been tightly held, even more so than any of her Cold War efforts, but those awards never would have been given had Parche not continued to pioneer new and dangerous missions. She can still tap cables, and since her refit, she can also retrieve military hardware off the ocean floor. The Navy, it is clear, is also determined to hold on to her. When the rash of post-Cold War base closings rang the end of the Mare Island Naval Shipyard in 1994, Parche was moved to Bangor, Washington, where she is the only attack sub to moor at a major Trident missile sub-base. The Navy has pushed her special technology forward and could even be using unmanned drones to swim out from Parche and handle much of the tasks of cable tapping without risking her crew's lives. Her targets are easy to guess at and no doubt reflect the Navy's broader intelligence concerns. Iran took possession of its third Kilo in 1997. The cover of one recent issue of Worldwide Submarine Challenges, a naval intelligence annual, pictures a Chinese submarine and crew. Inside is a running litany of nations that present a potential threat, including two Asian nations, China and North Korea. China not only used one of its Kilos in highly threatening exercises off Taiwan, but fired land missiles as warning shots, forcing Clinton to send U.S. aircraft carriers to ensure that no attack took place. The Chinese are also using Russian technology to develop their own fleet of modern nuclear missile subs, and they have been testing land-based ballistic missiles with ranges long enough to reach U.S. shores. Chinese test missiles fired into the oceans would be invaluable to the United States if they were retrieved. Finally, concerns about North Korea have escalated greatly. The country repeatedly has used diesel subs to try to infiltrate commandos into South Korea. Parche is still out there, as are other attack submarines bent on spying. The Navy has already earmarked a replacement for Parche, due to be retired in 2003. The third Seawolf-class submarine, USS Jimmy Carter, is being made lengthened so that she can carry Parchee's unique style gear and continue the sub-force's most sensitive missions. The program that began with the first chill of the Cold War continues. Epilogue. A sub-commander and his wife once made a promise. When he was at sea, they would both look at the same star at the same time of night. She would never know when he could dare bring his sub to periscope depth, dare take a peek at the sky. So she faithfully sought out their star every night at the appointed hour, even though she realized that he was probably moving silently through the darkness of the ocean. She did that in the hope that at least once they would be gazing at their star together. She did that every night until he came home. These two were among the lucky ones. The stress caused by long months at sea and the staunch secrecy that submariners were sworn to maintain tore many other couples apart. No final analysis of the submarine war can ignore the human costs. These men traded months, years, and more to become what was for decades the country's best defense against nuclear attack from the sea. Submariners tracked Soviet missile submarines as well as anyone could, development by development and mile by mile. Only another sub could follow a Soviet boomer, hear just what clanked, see just how its crew operated, and learn just where it would be going should the order ever come to fire. This was all intelligence that grew over time, a few facts from each mission, some of it redundant, much of it cumulative. It was intelligence that had to be collected all over again each time the Soviets put out a new class of subs, each time they came up with a new tactic. At their best, submarines did something more. They enabled the United States to get a glimpse inside the minds of Soviet military leaders. A U.S. captain in the midst of a trail could see himself in the decisions of a Soviet commander, just as he could see how the other man was so very different. The special fleet of submarines equipped to tap cables made it possible to listen as Soviet naval headquarters detailed day-to-day frustrations, critiqued missions, and reacted to fears of an American nuclear strike. At a point in time when both superpowers could start nuclear war with a push of a button, this was a rare and crucial look at who the adversary really was. Human agents, satellites, and spy planes, along with subs, all got very good at collecting information about Soviet hardware, what was being built, the technical specifications. It was much harder, however, to get a glimpse into the Soviet psyche. In the end, not even the cable taps could reveal much about what the top Soviet leadership thought, or show the true political and economic crises building in a country so closed. Still, the taps were often the best gauges anyone had, even when what they did record was trapped underwater for months until a sub could be sent to retrieve their tapes. The men who serviced those cables at the bottom of the Barents and Okhotsk knew they faced immense risk. The self-destruct charges they carried on board were a grim reminder. Even men who often stood as rivals to naval intelligence, top officers at the CIA, acknowledged that cable tapping was the most dangerous of any long-standing intelligence operation of the Cold War. That aura of danger awarded the missions respect, just as it made them especially rare. While satellites replaced many of the spy planes and made intelligence gathering safer and more antiseptic, submarines continued to confront the Soviets directly. That not only set subs apart from any other intelligence collectors, but from the rest of the military. Submariners knew they were part of the only force that practiced not simply against allies in war games, but by meeting the enemy, day in and day out. There was always a huge risk of a destabilizing incident, even the risk that a submarine might spark real battle. Occasionally, some critics worried publicly that this could have happened each time a submarine was detected in Soviet waters, each time one risked retaliation, each time there was a collision. There was no question that some skippers went too far in their quest for the big score. But when the Navy and the intelligence agencies weighed the gains against the possibility of a violent response, they relied on one simple fact. The Soviets were sending out their spies as well. As Admiral James D. Watkins, the former Chief of Naval Operations and Secretary of Energy, put it, "The fact that you get caught periodically is historical. So what? You know everybody's in the game." He went on to say, "As long as we're doing it, which you might say in a way that does not clearly violate agreements that we made or international laws we subscribe to, it is a fair game. We should never apologize for it. We've got to get on with it. And if we don't do it, we are not doing our job." There is more than a bit of doublespeak in his stress on spying in ways that do not clearly violate laws and agreements, and in his further limiting his thoughts to laws that we subscribe to. But looking back, it's clear that even the most violent submarine encounters never sparked real crisis, just as it's clear that the Soviets were writing their rules in much the same way. Most of the time, the United States was violating Soviet secrecy with the cable taps. The Soviets were getting the same kind of information, having enlisted John Walker and his spy ring to steal the codes that let them gaze right back at the U.S. Navy's soul. The Soviet Union's efforts to keep up with the United States military, especially its efforts to create a force of missile subs that could evade U.S. attack subs during the opening salvos of a nuclear war, clearly contributed to the country's ultimate bankruptcy. The contest was costly for the United States as well, as hundreds of billions of dollars were poured into building and manning nearly 200 nuclear subs and expanding the SOSUS net. Still, the intelligence gained also saved vast sums by helping to hone decisions about just what defense systems the United States really needed. Now that the Soviet bear is bankrupt and eviscerated, and the Cold War is over, the U.S. Navy's plans to build new subs have come under fire, and submarine budgets have been slashed. Men will still go to sea, still brave the depths to spy on enemies of the United States. But those enemies are more likely to be found in Third World hotspots, and for now, no other country poses as big or sweeping a problem at sea as the Soviet Union did. When Congress finally gets around to cutting overall intelligence budgets, which have been only slightly reduced from Cold War levels, it is likely that the sub force will be squeezed some more. Meanwhile, both Russia and the United States are still facing other enormous costs as they decommission many of their nuclear-powered subs and are forced to find some way to dispose of the reactors that powered them. Russia has the most daunting burden. It has the enormous and perhaps impossible job of cleaning up the Barents, of undoing the damage caused by the dumping of a dozen nuclear reactors, spent cores, and radioactive parts from old submarines into the waters near the northern island of Novaya Zemlya. Russia and the United States share something else as well. The secrecy that has been maintained on both sides about all Cold War sub-operations has left lingering pain, especially for the families of men lost in this Cold War under the seas. For instance, neither Navy has yet offered conclusive answers about the disappearance of the subs they lost in 1968, not the Americans about Scorpion, and not the Russians about the Gulf. Soviet officials simply marked the Gulf's men as missing and were so determined to bury their embarrassing secret that they refused to bestow the honors and pensions that normally went to loved ones of those who suffered a military death. A death that occurred in Soviet parlance while executing the combat task. Instead, wives were given a one-time payment of 1,500 rubles and an annual pension of 58 rubles for each child and disabled relative of the dead men. Irina Zhuravina, who lost her husband on the Gulf, refused to spend those rubles because she thought that would be reconciling to her husband's death on her government's terms. After the Gulf was lost, she was working at the customs office at an airport where foreign newspapers and magazines were collected, censored or confiscated outright, and she began reading the forbidden pages, risking imprisonment as she did so. Year after year she kept at it, hoping that news from another country could tell her how her husband had died. It wasn't until 7 years after Halibut found the Gulf that Zhuravina came across the account of the Glomar recovery attempt in a Western magazine. That's how she learned that her husband's submarine had gone down, that the Americans had found it, tried to raise it, and brought up at least 6 bodies, 6 men who were prevented by politics from coming home. But when she asked, her government refused to acknowledge any of this. Andrei Kobzar, who was the captain's son, got the same kind of evasive answers when he wrote to several directorates about his father, Vladimir Ivanovich Kobzar. Finally, he went to the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. Surely someone there could tell him something. But the U.S. diplomats held firm to their non-disclosure agreement with the Kremlin, held firm to their conspiracy of silence. Then, 2 years after the Soviet Union disappeared, Robert M. Gates decided to make what he considered a dramatic gesture as he prepared to become the first CIA director to visit the Kremlin. Somebody at the CIA mentioned that the crew of the Glomar had videotaped the burial at sea they had given the 6 recovered Gulf submariners. Gates fought for and won permission to bring the tape with him to his first meeting with Boris Yeltsin. 2 weeks later, the tape aired on Soviet national television. The Gulf families got to see American sailors standing at attention as both national anthems were played and as the Americans added Russian prayers to the Naval Service for the Dead. Kobzar, Zhuravina, and the rest were astonished and moved that Americans, their enemies for so long, would treat their men with such respect. Still, the tape wasn't enough, any more than the declassified pictures of Scorpion's remains were enough to appease the families who lost men on that sub. In the United States and in Russia, families of the dead, and of the living, have been calling for more. They have wanted their governments to give up their remaining secrets. Some want simply to lay their men to rest. Others want the answers to all of those questions that have been so long forbidden. They want to know, was it all worth it? Perhaps the entire nuclear arms race was insane. But once it existed, spy subs became a crucial part of dealing with that insanity. That subs were lost to technological failures and in a rush to the sea is horrible. But once nuclear missiles were put on submarines, there had to be a way to track them, to threaten them, to ensure that neither country felt safe enough to use them. For the Soviet Union, that meant trying to keep the United States from knowing just how many failures their nuclear subs were suffering. For the United States, it meant trying to keep the Soviets from knowing just how truly vulnerable their subs were. With stakes this high, there were valid reasons for secrecy. But obsessive secrecy tends to feed on itself, obscuring critical lessons from the past, lessons that are being lost forever as generations of men who lived that past are dying. Now, with the end of the Cold War and a new phase in submarine espionage beginning, it's time to look back, time to assess what has so long been hidden.
The End. You've been listening to Blind Man's Bluff, The Untold Story of American Submarine Espionage, by Sherry Sontag and Christopher Drew, with Annette Lawrence Drew, narrated by George K. Wilson. Following the epilogue of Blind Man's Bluff, the authors include 2 appendices, one on submarine collisions and the other entitled From the Soviet Side. We include these appendices here, again read by George K. Wilson.
Appendix A. Submarine Collisions. Throughout the Cold War, there were dozens of submarine accidents as boats that relied on sound for sight came as close as they dared to the enemy, sometimes too close. None of these accidents were as severe as Tautog's collision with the Black Lila, but even a relatively minor bump by a 4,000-ton vessel is enough to send men and their craft reeling. Here are some of the other incidents caused when submarines sent on spec ops by the United States and Great Britain slammed into or were hit by Soviet subs and ships or other vessels. This list includes collisions that were confirmed and others considered probable. Some have never been disclosed before. 1960 to 1961, USS Swordfish. While Swordfish, SSN 579, was on a surveillance mission off the Soviet Pacific coast, a Soviet sub apparently attempted to surface from directly below. The American boat was at periscope depth when it suddenly shook from an impact. One crew member recalls that the officer at the con looked through the scope and saw running lights. Lights along port and starboard that a sub might turn on as it surfaced. By the time Swordfish itself came to the surface, the ocean was clear. The crew assumed that the Soviet sub had dived back down. Early 1960s, unidentified sub, possibly USS Skipjack. One former Navy intelligence official clearly remembers an incident in which a U.S. sub got tangled up with a Soviet destroyer in the Barents Sea. He wasn't sure, but believed that the sub was Skipjack, SSN 585. He was certain, however, that the American boat came home with a propeller gouge on the sail. This may be one of the incidents that Seymour M. Hersh mentioned in the New York Times in May 1975, when he described an unnamed Holystone sub that was damaged when it surfaced underneath a Soviet ship in the midst of a Soviet fleet naval exercise. Hersh also reported that the sub suffered damage to its conning tower and escaped despite a search by Soviet vessels. July 1965, USS Medrigal. Medrigal, SS 480, smashed into and crippled a Greek cargo freighter that was under surveillance because it was suspected of carrying supplies to enemy forces in Vietnam. The accident happened in the Gulf of Tonkin when the diesel sub was being driven by a temporary commander. Medrigal's regular skipper had broken his neck diving into a swimming pool during a port stop in the Philippines. March 1966, USS Barbel. Barbel, SS 580, one of the last diesel subs the Navy built, collided with a freighter suspected of carrying arms near a port on Hainan Island, China, across the Gulf of Tonkin from North Vietnam. The force of the collision tore the sailplanes from the ship, probably lodging parts of them in the ship's hull. The collision was hard enough that Barbel was forced down, hitting bottom about 100 feet underwater. The Vietnamese later reported that the freighter had sunk when it hit a submerged object. Indeed, the Barbel collision was especially upsetting to Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, because he had earlier instructed Navy leaders to keep U.S. subs out of the area to avoid inflaming tensions. Barbel remained submerged, backed away from the freighter, and left without checking what happened to the sailors on the ship. December 1967, USS George C. Marshall. Marshall, SSBN 654, a Polaris missile sub, was clipped by a Soviet sub in the Mediterranean Sea. The Americans knew the Soviet sub was there, but couldn't move their massive boat away fast enough. Crewmen say the collision was a glancing blow, but noted that it still left a gash in Marshall's forward starboard ballast tank. October 9, 1968, unidentified American or British attack sub. Russian Navy officials say this was the first collision involving a NATO surveillance sub and a Soviet nuclear boat in the Barents Sea. They told our Russian researcher, Alexander Mozgovy, that the Soviet sub was operating normally, when suddenly it began listing starboard, its hull shaking. The crew quickly surfaced, and through the periscope sighted another submarine silhouette. With the conning tower hatch now jammed, the Soviets used a sledgehammer to open it, and it was several minutes before the commander could climb outside to the bridge. By then, the waters were clear. Back at base, repair crews discovered a hole in the outer hull so large that one of the sub's officers said, "A 3-ton truck could easily have driven through." Judging from small bits of red and green glass and metal fragments stuck in the wreckage, the Soviets concluded that they had been hit by a foreign sub. Soviet intelligence later discovered that a British diesel sub had pulled into Norway with a damaged sail around that time. However, the Soviets also believe they could have been hit by a U.S. sub. November 1969, USS Gato. The sail of the Gato, SSN 615, was scraped by the hull of the Soviet hotel-class missile sub known as Hiroshima, when Hiroshima passed over the American boat. The men on Gato heard a dull grind as the subs bumped. Despite Soviet Admiral Gorshkov's wish that Gato's corpse be recovered, the sub escaped, and nobody on board was hurt. March 14, 1970, USS Sturgeon. As Sturgeon, SSN 637, passed over a Soviet sub in the Barents Sea, the men on board could hear crunching. Sturgeon's sonar dome had grazed the top of the Soviet sub's sail, scraping off pieces of steel. The pieces became lodged in the grating under Sturgeon's ballast tanks. June 1970, USS Tautog. In one of the most violent collisions of the Cold War, Tautog, SSN 639, was rammed by the Soviet Echo 2 submarine Black Lila off Petropavlovsk. President Nixon was briefed that taped sonar sounds indicated the Soviet sub had sunk, though now her captain has come forward to say that his sub survived. March 1971. Unidentified sub. On March 31, 1971, another Holystone sub collided with a Soviet boat, according to Hirsch's May 1975 story in the New York Times. Hirsch cited a memo addressed to CIA Director Richard M. Helms that put the collision 17 nautical miles off the Soviet coast. Mid-1971, USS Dace. After Dace, SSN 607, hit something that rolled her to one side, her men were almost certain they had bumped a Soviet submarine in the Mediterranean. Indeed, naval intelligence later learned that a Soviet sub pulled into a port soon afterward with the kind of damage that would have been expected from an impact with another sub. Late 1971 or early 1972, USS Puffer. Puffer, SSN 652, collided with a Soviet diesel sub in waters near Petropavlovsk when the Soviet boat took an unexpected dive just as Puffer was making one last surveillance pass. Both subs were moving at slow speed, and crewmen on Puffer say it was almost as if the Soviet boat sank on top of them and bumped. May 1974, USS Pintado. Pintado, SSN 672, collided with a Soviet sub inside Soviet waters in the approaches to Petropavlovsk, according to a story in the San Diego Evening Tribune in July 1975. Both subs were about 200 feet deep at impact. Crewmen said the collision smashed much of Pintado's detection sonar, jammed a torpedo tube hatch, and damaged a diving control fin. The Soviet sub, a Yankee-class ballistic missile boat, surfaced soon after the crash. The crewmen said that they believed Pintado had gone close to the Soviet harbor to check Soviet undersea defense systems. After the collision, Pintado raced from the scene. November 3, 1974, USS James Madison. Madison, SSBN 627, was leaving the U.S. submarine base at Holy Loch, Scotland, when she collided with a Soviet attack sub in the North Sea, according to reports by the columnist Jack Anderson and the Norwich, Connecticut Bulletin in 1975. Madison dove onto the Soviet boat, which was shrouded by the noise of her baffles. One former Madison crew member noted that the Soviet sub was probably one of the Victor class. Late 1981, HMS Scepter of Great Britain's Royal Navy. This nuclear-powered British attack submarine collided with a Soviet nuclear sub that she was trailing in northern waters close to the Arctic, according to reports a decade later in the British media. One officer said Scepter had lost contact with the Soviet boat for as long as 30 minutes before his boat shook. "There was a huge noise," he said, adding, "Everybody went white." October 1986, USS Augusta. In an especially embarrassing moment, Augusta, SSN 710, bumped into a Soviet missile sub in the Atlantic while testing a new, highly computerized sonar system that had promised to make it easier to detect other vessels. The attack happened a few days after a Soviet Yankee-class missile sub caught fire and sank off Bermuda, owing to problems with one of its missile tubes. But contrary to the story told in Hostile Waters, a 1997 home box office movie, Augusta crew members and naval intelligence officials say Augusta did not hit the Yankee. Instead, the Augusta collided with a Delta I-class sub. The lingering confusion is the ultimate irony for Augusta's captain, who had once been so confident of his own abilities that he tacked a plaque on his stateroom door, endowing himself with the lofty title Augusta Caesar. December 24, 1986, HMS Splendid of Great Britain's Royal Navy. According to Russian Navy officials, Splendid was surveying a Soviet sub in the Northern Fleet's training range in the Barents Sea when the Soviets noticed and tried to get away. The Russians say that at that point, commanders of both subs made maneuvering mistakes, and the Soviet submarine brushed against Splendid, snagging its towed sonar array. The Soviet sub, possibly one of the huge Typhoon missile boats, made her way back to base, still entwined in the array. February 11, 1992, USS Baton Rouge. Baton Rouge, SSN 689, collided with a Russian Sierra-class sub near Murmansk. In an unprecedented move, and in response to Yeltsin's complaints, the Pentagon publicly announced that the collision had occurred. March 20, 1993, USS Grayling. Grayling, SSN 646, collided with a Russian Delta III missile sub in the Barents Sea. Nobody was hurt, but Clinton was furious that the Navy was still taking such risks. Appendix B. From the Soviet side. The U.S. Navy spent decades spying on Soviet submarines, but never really knew much about what went on inside those boats, who their men were, or what they were going through. Periodically, word would come of horrible radiation accidents. The Pentagon was willing enough to share those incidents with the American public, along with constant and seemingly contradictory warnings about how big and dangerous the Soviet sub-fleet was becoming. Now, with the end of the Cold War, the Russian Navy has opened up and has been willing to offer some of the details about the tense days back when the Soviet Navy scrambled to catch up to the Americans. Former Soviet submariners feel free to say what they never could before, that their commands put more emphasis on numbers and deadlines than on submarine safety. As a result, the Soviets suffered some of the most horrific accidents of the Cold War. A lethal beginning. In the early stages of the arms race in the mid-1950s, Khrushchev called for the Soviet Union to catch up with and pass America. And so a fleet of nuclear submarines was designed and constructed, all in a hurry, all haphazardly. The work was so bad that in 1959 Commander Vladimir N. Chernavin, who would ultimately succeed Admiral Gorshkov as Commander-in-Chief of the Soviet Navy, refused to take one of the first Soviet nuclear attack submarines out of the yard for her first sea trials. He stood firm when his command was threatened, and he stood firm until his sub was repaired. While Chernavin stood his ground, another submarine, the K-19, had already been sent to sea with the swing of a champagne bottle. That the bottle failed to break was one of those omens that every submariner, no matter what his rank, rate, or nationality, knew to be ominous. It was an inauspicious beginning for the first Soviet nuclear-powered submarine to carry ballistic missiles. In the summer of 1961, K-19 was setting out for exercises in the North Atlantic, exercises codenamed Arctic Circle. She was to play the role of an American sub, hide beneath the surface, and make her way through Soviet anti-submarine forces. After that, she was going to leave the rest of the fleet and find a polynya, a break in the ice. She would surface at the edge of the Arctic and conduct a practice launch of a ballistic missile. The rest of the fleet stayed behind to continue their exercises as K-19 broke away to make a submerged transit through the Norwegian Sea. The waters were calm. There were no storms. Her crew was already counting down to the end of this cruise and their homecoming. On July 4th at 4:15 in the morning, just as the sub reached a point about 100 miles off of Jan Mayen, the small Norwegian island above Iceland, K-19's radiation detection equipment came to life. A reactor scrammed, shutting down. The fuel rods in her nuclear core continued to heat. The primary cooling circuit had failed. A pipe had burst. Pumps had broken, leaving nothing to control the chain reaction, nothing to stop the rods from heating up, nothing to prevent them from getting so hot that they would melt through the reactor itself. As the fuel rods climbed past,